counted among the outlaws, he said, "Come, follow me." People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.
Welcome to Becoming Outlaws. If this is your first time here, Becoming Outlaws, we engage celebrities, scholars, different diverse voices in candid conversations about following Jesus, defying societal norms, and explaining profound and often not so profound questions of faith. And today we entitled this Drink of the Gods. Before we get started, please subscribe on whatever platform you are listening to or viewing this. Like it, share it. It helps the algorithms so more people, you know, can listen in the future. You know the deal. Thank you. There's a newly released book, and from what I understand, it's doing pretty well, called Blood from a Stone, a memoir of how wine brought me back from the dead. And you can tell from the title why I grabbed it. I was interested, got through it quickly so I could talk to the author. It's the personal account of a graveyard shift hospice chaplain and grief counselor who, through struggles and various detours in life, finds his way to becoming a wine expert and living in the California wine country as a sommelier and giving wine tours, a whole different life that at once maybe seemed like a fantasy, and he made that transition. What I found most personally I liked about this tale was the history presented of wine throughout civilization, the various cultures. It's always been like the drink of kings through history, the drink of gods. It's the center of community, the center of family life, and even makes its way as a representation of the heart of Christianity, and even a toast to the kingdom to come, all from a drink. Adam McHugh is a wine tour guide, sommelier, and a certified specialist of wine. He's also the author of a couple few other books, one being The Listening Life of Introverts, another in the Introverts in the Church. And he's a regular contributor to Edible Santa Barbara and Wine Country. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, thanks for coming. Glad you're here. So let's start with the title. So Blood from a Stone. For one, it's an appealing title. It kind of grabs you a little bit. I'm familiar with you can't get blood from a turnip. Blood from a Stone, is that the same kind of concept? And what does it mean to you? And why is it the head title of your memoir?
It's a phrase that I first heard in the south of France when I was on a wine tour about 15 years ago. There's a very famous wine region down in the Provence region, not far from the town of Avignon, called Châteauneuf du Pape, which means new house or new chateau of the Pope. Because believe it or not, there was about a 70-year period where the papal throne was located in Avignon rather than in Rome. It was relocated in the 1300s. And so I was on this wine tour, and one of the big features of the Châteauneuf du Pape wine region, instead of dirt between the vines, you have these big round rocks called galettes. And you have these shrubs, these kind of grape shrubs growing out of these rocks, right? And so I mentioned to our wine tour guide, I have no idea how anything can grow out of this sort of soil and out of these huge rocks. And this wine tour guide says, that's why the local expression here is that making wine is like squeezing blood from a stone. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And people don't ever believe me when I say this, but I honestly said to myself in that moment, I'm going to write a book by that title. And I did. About 10 years later, but I finally did it.
Yeah, the subtitle, Memoir About Wine Brought Me Back from the Dead. So typically you'd expect stories, getting away from alcohol brought me back from the dead. So yours is a twist on that, obviously, and it's catchy. And just to ask you, how did wine bring you back from the dead? That's the whole book. So it's kind of a big question. But in general, what do you mean by that?
Right. So it's a play on a few different things. And it's the subtitle seems to draw a lot of people in. So I'm happy about that. But the simplest level is actually pretty straightforward, in that before I moved to, I'm in what's called the Santa Ynez Valley of California here on the central coast north of Santa Barbara. Before I moved up here, got into the world of wine. I used to live down in the LA area near Pasadena, and I was a hospice chaplain. I worked with people who have been given a terminal diagnosis, and I actually worked a lot of nights more than days, at least in the second stint that I did that job. And so I was going from home to home, often on what we call death visits, where the patient had died and I had to go and comfort the family and sort of wait for the mortuary to show up and be with them. And so that was my life for years, was being with those people who have been given 6 months to live or less. And now I live here in wine country, and which is so full of life and so full of abundance, and it feels so very different from the life of grief and loss that I used to live day in and day out. So the trajectory of the whole book, of my whole work, is from hospice chaplain to wine tour guide and sommelier, and that kind of, you know, that's the overarching plot of the whole book. So back from the dead, obviously there's multiple meanings there, but I'm specifically referring to my time working with people who had just died.
Yeah, and I'm trying to recall, what did you call yourself? The Grim Reaper's...
Grim Reaper's wingman.
Wingman, yeah. I almost titled this episode "The Grim Reaper's Wingman," but I didn't want to focus just on the hospice part. But I thought that was a good title. I
like, right, because the hospice part is like the first, you know, third of the book, and then the rest of it is me sort of grappling with a new life and wine, yeah, and letting go of my sort of role and identity as an ordained minister and as a hospice chaplain.
As a hospice chaplain. So most people listening know what hospice is, but that's where you go to die comfortably.
Exactly.
Is a way to put it. So you go there expecting not to come out, and your family expects this person or you not to come out, and you're the guy they call to comfort family and to help people pass from this life to the next. And what's that do for a person? Does that take a special kind of person, or what kind of person ends up with that job? And not only did you have that job, you had like the graveyard shift. It's like a culmination of burden, wouldn't it be?
Yeah. Those last few years, I worked, I did a couple of stints in hospice. And the first few years I worked during the day, and that actually really helped kind of brighten your mood, just having sunlight streaming through these windows. But then just sort of due to the economy back in like 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. when everything fell apart, the only work that I could find was working the midnight to 8 on call shift, often 3 to 5 nights a week. And so not only was I, and so normally what I was called for was what we call death visits, where someone had just died, and then it was just required for the hospice service that someone would go and be with the family, and that was usually the chaplain. And then but I would have to drive through these, you know, dark LA freeways. I lived about 45 minutes east of where most of our patients were. And so, you know, I was sort of felt like I was kind of the walking dead myself, you know, driving through these dark, kind of smoggy LA freeways to houses I'd never been to be with people that I had never met, and to try to bring some teaspoon of comfort to their lives. And, you know, one of the darkest nights of their life. And so not only was it just an emotional, you know, was it emotionally taxing to be doing that sort of job? And often one of the hardest parts was just that they were strangers every single time. I had no familiarity with them at all, and I would never see them again. But then you're living sort of in reverse. I was living during the dark hours of the night when everyone else was sleeping, and then I would kind of sleep in fits throughout most of the morning and the early afternoon, and wake up in the evening when everyone else had kind of finished their day and I was just starting my day. And it was very disorienting in so many different ways. Yeah. That being said, I should say, you know, the job itself was very meaningful at times. It was very, like, there were very profound moments when you hold someone's hand as they take their last breath, which I did on multiple occasions. And so it was kind of strange and special work. And I don't want to discount that, but it changed me really in so many different ways. But at the same time, the sort of the emotional burden and the psychological burden was just this slow leak on my soul that eventually just made it impossible for me to do that work anymore.
Yeah, I can imagine. Is there a high turnover rate for that work?
It's yes and no. There were some people that absolutely astounded me that just seemed like they were just tailor-made for that work. One of my colleagues, I think she was about 75 and she just couldn't retire. It was just the work that she loved, and she had done it for 40 years, and it was just what got her up in the morning, and she loved it. But then there were lots of people like myself who struggled a lot with what's called compassion fatigue, which feels like depression, though it's a little bit more circumstantial than medical depression. And so there was a fair amount of turnover among the social workers and chaplains, but then there were some people that just seemed tailor-made for the job. I was not one of those people.
Yeah. Before we move on to a little more cheery and gladness with wine, yeah. And for you personally, dealing with death, hands-on, face-to-face kind of thing, or at least within the moments after, most people avoid, nobody likes to go to funerals. It's not a good time. Nobody likes to face their own mortality. And it's hard to look at. Death is hard to look at. Sick and suffering is hard to look at. But yet one of my favorite scriptures, and actually as soon as I started a Facebook account many years ago, it says like, quote, or what's your favorite quote? You could put it. Mine's always been Ecclesiastes 2:7, just because it's so important that it's better to be in the house of mourning than a house of feasting, because death is the destiny of every man and the living should take this to heart. And there's a lot of soul changes or reflection or contemplation, which I noticed was one of your job descriptions in a bio. it said writer, author, sommelier, contemplative. I thought that is like the coolest. I want to add that to mine just to add, like, I think about stuff. Right. Seriously, I think about stuff as right. a job. Anyway, where you contemplate mortality, not everybody does it. And when they do, or the Billy Grahams of the world were so successful as evangelists because they make you for a moment think about your own mortality if you died today. And then they give you a message and it hits you. But somebody who lived in the culture of facing mortality, what's that do to a person? Did that, I know you had compassion fatigue, but did it heighten your faith, strengthen it, or did it just make you, did it have an opposite effect because death is so horrible?
It was very complicated. And I mean, the answer to that question is yes. I experienced on many, many occasions, you know, a compassion fatigue that felt like depression, because it just kind of felt like there was a futility to what I was doing in my work. There was a futility to what we're all doing in our lives, because there is an end to all of this. And really a lot of the hardest part was not actually watching people die. The hardest part was watching people watch people die. Yeah. Watching these family members lose people that they had in their lives for 80 years, 90 years, 30 years, sometimes a lot less. But that was the hardest part for me, was watching people grieve their loved ones die. That was what made the biggest impact on me. So there was certainly an aspect where I began to treasure my family relationships, my friend relationships, my marriage, more, even more than I did before. But I think actually what it drove me to do was to sort of see there is an end to all of this. And the dreams that I have within me are not going to bubble forever. And so I think ultimately it was hospice that drove me to seek other passions, another lifestyle that I never would have gotten to if I hadn't have spent so much time watching people die. And, you know, in some ways it was a faith strengthener. In some ways it was actually very difficult for my faith to watch people grieve so often. And you get kind of this skewed perspective on humanity. And it kind of feels like it leaves you with nowhere to go when you spend that much time with death. But I think ultimately it actually just said, well, I have these dreams, I have these passions, and I want to seek another life because of what I have seen here.
Yeah. And you mentioned futility, which is interesting, or life's futility when you see death so much. But that's the whole theme of Ecclesiastes, is, and kind of what you're living is, you got to face the futility of life, because, and you might as well make sure you like obey God, follow God, but eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you make a pretty cool like tour guide, with, because you bring a level of depth and understanding to life where it's not just toasting and living a California lifestyle in the vineyard countries with a naivete of life, but with a depth of, you can, I think, it extra enjoy a drink of the fruit of the vine and a good meal with friends and an afternoon on the countryside, sharing knowledge with people, knowing that this is a pleasure, but you can, I would think, bring some kind of sense of, well, I guess, the lack of naivete, that it, you could appreciate the pleasure more.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, I drive these people all the time, every week from Santa Barbara up to our wine country here, the San Ynez Valley. And there's all sorts of fascinating conversations that come up when you're spending that much time in a car with people. And I think I'm always aware that, you know, these vacations that people are on, these little wine tours that I'm taking people on, is really a respite for them in a really hard life. I'm always aware now of the challenges that everyone faces, and it definitely can make me appreciate more like these 6 hours or so that I get to introduce people to these beautiful places and talk to them about the wines and geology and all the different like history and features of this area. And it's never frivolous for me. It's not just, you know, this it's a luxury in the sense that I'm aware now of the hard realities of life that every single person faces, whether they're rich or poor. And I'm able to not just show them a good time, but I think help people appreciate just the moment that they're getting to experience together in this beautiful place.
Yeah. In reading your book, it's a great combination, because I'm not a wine connoisseur, and that I would buy a wine book and want to know about wine. I don't know the notes of wine and one tastes good or one tastes bad. That's about my education level. And so I think someone who does know all of that would find your book really interesting and entertaining. It's funny. But even someone who's not, the storytelling is grabbing, but as well as it came off to me, as I'm sure you know and appreciate the notes and the flavors. But it seems to me that, and what you brought out of it for me was the enjoyment of the bottle you have based on not just what it tastes like, but the soil it came from, the community that had a heritage of families handed it down for 100 years. That's all they've known, and they personally cultivated this, and you had to have this kind of goat with this kind of whatever to make this kind of whatever to put in the mix, and it only comes from this little village off in whatever country. And then you have, if you sat with the family or learned about their culture and enjoyed that with them in conversation and community, then you go back and you buy that or order it or off the shelf or whatever, and you drink it. That's a whole nother multi-layer then, but that tastes good or bad.
Yeah. And I'm happy to hear you say that. And the idea was that I was going to try to write a wine book that non-wine people would actually enjoy, you know, give it up to the readers to determine whether I pulled that off or not. But I tried to be funny, which wasn't easy to do in a book that has a lot to do with hospice and grief and death. But I knew the book could get really gloomy if I didn't try to lighten it. But I like what you're saying. For me, wine, I actually really, I've studied wine very carefully now for 15 years. And so, yes, I can do the notes and I can get as pretentious as I want about evaluating the sensory, you know, experiences of a particular wine. But for me, wine is really about place. And my whole journey has been about seeking a sense of place, a sense of belonging, an attachment to the soil that's under my feet and the people who cultivate the vine and make the wine like an attachment, like a communal attachment to them as well. And so for me, wine has this amazing transporting effect where it can be this portal into a different place and a different time. And if you have gone and met these farmers like I did in the south of France on that trip and tasted wine in their farmhouses or in their barns, and then when you bring that wine home or you find it in a store and you open it, it's like a liquid memory kind of coming alive again. And so that the reason why I keep holding on to wine so much is not just because I really like how it tastes or smells, but because it takes me to particular places. And it also feels like here living in the San Ynez Valley, where, you know, most of my favorite wines are, it grounds me, it gives me a foundation. And so it's that sense of place that really keeps me holding on to wine as much as I do.
Yeah. And you threw in, I'm kind of a history buff, so I latched onto this, references to the history of wine. And it really has been through antiquity, through different cultures as a main drink. And I would assume a lot of that has to do with the lack of clean water or bacteria in the water. So they have a somewhat fermented drink to kill the bacteria. But what's some examples of just how far back it goes and how it was represented and why it was like a drink of kings or the drinks of gods and religion?
Right. As far as I know, the history of wine goes back about 8,000 years, and the earliest evidence of winemaking has been discovered in the Caucasus Mountains of southern Georgia near the Black Sea. And from there, it seemed like it moved along what we call the Fertile Crescent or Mesopotamia, south of the Black Sea, and then along to what's called the Levant, which we would call Palestine and Israel and what was ancient Syria at the time, and then down into Egypt. And I love the history. I was a history major in college, and I studied a lot of history in grad school as well. And that's why I had to wrap a lot of the history of wine around my own story, because I'm just so fascinated by all of that. And wine was the wine of kings for one simple reason at first, and that's because it was really expensive. It was very hard to make. Ancient Egypt, it was really the emperors and sort of the noble classes that were able to afford it. It was too hot in most of Egypt to be able to grow grapevines. And so they had to import it from Israel. Actually, was a huge supplier of some of the best wines in Egypt. And so you just couldn't afford it. And then it wasn't really until the Greeks, you know, centuries later, that wine became a little bit more democratized and sort of your all classes of people began able to afford it because the climate was better. And then by the time we got to the Romans, it was a pretty ubiquitous thing, though it was still always a status symbol. And the Romans made sure that all of their soldiers marching throughout the Mediterranean always had a good supply of wine from Italy. But then they started planting grapevines everywhere they went along the Mediterranean. So the Roman Empire really helped shape what's now the modern wine industry.
And as far as like biblical history goes, which intertwines with just history itself, I mean, we see it all through Scripture. Whether we, in our particular upbringing, wanted to look at that or not, it's mentioned hundreds of times. Yeah. It's considered a gift from God to humankind. It's Jesus' first miracle was turning water into a wine for a party, and not the first, after they already ran out. He gave them more to drink. Have a good time. Yeah. And well, you know, is it the first thing we see of a new civilization in the story of Noah is him being drunk, but he had to plant a vineyard to do that. He plants a vineyard, one of his first things to do. Then we get down to even Jesus himself using the drink as a symbol of blood for the new covenant of all mankind's salvation. And then goes as far as to say, I'm not going to drink this again with you, the fruit of the vine, until I drink it with you anew in a kingdom. Like, it'll be a heavenly toast for an arrival of a kingdom to come. Besides, his parables were full of vineyards and wines and wine tenders and new and old wine skins. You can't get away from it being a part of culture. Mm-hmm. In that, have you gathered, do you feel like, a depth of having been an ordained minister and an expert in wine? So you have an interest in history, in scripture, in wine, to have some kind of maybe formulated idea of wine or a layer of depth of understanding that maybe us common lay people wouldn't have or don't respect.
What's amazing to me is all the intersections between what I studied in seminary, you know, 20 plus years ago, to what I study in wine now. And I mean, it's because it goes back to the ancient world and through all the great empires of the ancient world, especially, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, who were, of course, contemporaries of, you know, first century Judaism that we study in the Gospels. And what that's what amazes me about it is that wine is a symbol of life, as a symbol of abundance. And I mean, you go back to when the spies in the book of Joshua, like, spy out Canaan, right? They go to see the promised land as they're coming out of the wilderness and getting ready to come into Jericho. And what is it that they bring back as a symbol of how good the promised land is? It's a huge grape cluster that's suspended between, you know, that's on a pole that's hanging down from poles, which is actually over centuries come to represent Jesus on the cross for a lot of Christians. And you know, that's the symbol of the good life and the abundance and the blessings of God that are offered in this land. And that theme runs all the way through scripture, that wine is a gift of God. Psalm 104 says, you know, to gladden the human heart. That's my favorite text in the scriptures. And as a blessing and as something that is given to us, not only to, you know, and so in the ancient world, absolutely, there it was used as an antiseptic because the water supply was sort of suspect, really, until Roman aqueducts. And so, yeah, the acids and alcohols absolutely would kill any bacteria that might make you sick. But that wasn't the only purpose. It was used as for rituals. It was used as a symbol of the good life. It was used as an expression of community and conviviality and joy. And, you know, so much so that it's the picture we have of what the kingdom is going to be like, at that wine at the center of the table, because of what it represents. So there's just so many layers that you can easily, and I plan to spend an entire lifetime studying.
This is random, but it's how my brain worked. Did you know that Nikola Tesla was known for taking a shot of whiskey every day just to kill the bacteria in his system?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, except during Prohibition, because he didn't want to be a rule breaker, so he stopped. And then when Prohibition ended, he started up with a shot of whiskey.
That's funny. It would work. It's probably why a lot of, like, Latin countries, like, eat really spicy peppers to kill the bacteria in your stomach as well. But personally, I'm a fan of more imbibing and as really sort of a communal expression of joy and coming together. Yeah.
So let's talk about that, the communal expression. So here we're living in a culture where people don't even sit down to dinner anymore. Right. And it's a social media relationships as opposed to in person. And if you do, it's a loud restaurant, or they're just, I mean, some families keep the culture, but if you do, it's usually because it's a cultural family who's kept tradition, that you sit around with family and friends. And like you see in scripture, they just recline at a table and they're laughing and talking and they're having gross, probably little fish, raw fish, whatever they'd eat back in the Mediterranean, whatever they had their diet. And they're drinking wine, and it's just a symbol of that.
Yeah.
Of living a life together. And they had hard lives, hard physical lives. easy death, young deaths, and all this. But they could forget all of that over some good food, relaxation, some wine, and just enjoy life in each other.
Totally.
And that's what seems like wine. I'm not trying to glorify wine anyway, but that's what the Bible symbolizes. And it seems like that's what we see through culture. And that's what I got out of your book anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I say in the book is that nobody hurries away from the table when there's good wine on the table. And it's something you talk about how does place shape you, and living in wine country has very much slowed me down. We kind of moved to the rhythm of life here according to the seasons of the vines anyway. And so there's often not a lot of hurry, though we're getting the harvest, and that's the only time there's any real sense of urgency around here. But those long meals around the table, I mean, those are with people that you love. And you know, newcomers that you want to meet are all some of my favorite moments in life, for sure. And I think we can trace that back, you know, thousands of years. And you said it exactly right, that life is hard, life is short, especially as it was back then. And those moments were moments of respite and peace and joy, and they still are today. I come from a family where Sunday night dinner was very much sacred, and my wife and I have, you know, kind of continued that on. And the only day actually of the week that we actually open a bottle of wine, like I'll taste wine all the time, but it's the only time we really sit and enjoy a bottle of wine is on Sunday nights. And we, you know, stretch out that meal as long as we possibly can. So it feels like a special and sacred time for us.
Yeah. So the book is a journey from hospice chaplain, you had struggling home life, a marriage, lost work. And I've been in both of those places and at the same time. So I could totally relate, but yet you were so focused on, I'm going to go to France and I'm going to have these events. I'm going to learn about Van Gogh, visit the space Van Gogh was and all this. And looking back on this, I think you called it a corkscrew path.
Yeah.
To get to where you are today, which we're all still on a journey, right? Yeah, but you're a successful author and you enjoy what you're doing, you like where you live and such. Do you see, looking back, that corkscrew path as a providential hand popping the cork of the wine of your life?
I haven't quite thought of it in terms of that language. It's hard to say, and I don't want to sugarcoat it. My journey has been very tumultuous. I went through all kinds of upheaval to be where I am now. I went through a divorce. I went through a brutally hard job that I lost, and that was, and then I went through this whole process of, I'm glad I had the language of grief as part of my job, that then I could apply that to the life transition that I went through that took years for me to really let go of my previous life, let go of my role and my identity as an ordained minister that I had spent so much time preparing to be. Of letting go of, you know, of so many different things. Therapy was a big help for me in that. And so I'm so happy that I had that language to say, I'm actually grieving the loss of someone that I used to be and a life that I used to have. It's not something I'm going to be able to rush through. This is going to take a long time. And I'm going to be sort of in between for a while in the wilderness, as I put it in the book. And so my life now, I'm genuinely happy. I have a good, healthy marriage. I like the work that I do. I got to spend years writing this book. And so, you know, it's easier to sort of praise God in the midst, you know, in this sort of situation. But I just, you know, I had to go through that grief in order to be here. But I can say fully that I am incredibly grateful and much more probably aware of how like good my life is at this point after having gone through all of that pain.
Right. And you mentioned being a former ordained minister. Ordained minister is interesting to me because because we're all ministers, right? And everything we do, do you see, I mean, your life still is, you know, ministry as you go through it. We're all called to go out and just live life and enjoy it and grow in faith and share it in the way that's put before us. It could be a sommelier, it could be a writer, or, you know, school teacher, whatever. But do you feel like you're a former minister or a former ordained minister?
I don't know if I would separate it that much. I don't usually use the language of ministry anymore. I wouldn't call myself a minister or in ministry in any capacity, to be honest. It's just not language that I really use anymore. However, that being said, like, one of the lines that I use when people say, when I tell them I used to be a hospice chaplain and a Presbyterian minister, and now I work in wine, and they say, what an incredible change. And I say, well, they're not that different. I used to listen to medicated people in my previous work, and I still listen to medicated people in my current yeah. work. They're just a lot happier now. And so listening and presence, those vital lessons that I learned through my work as a hospice chaplain, things that I did not really have as part of my temperament before, that have been, I live that day after day, no matter what context I'm in. And it's absolutely amazing what sort of conversations you can get into when you have sort of a slower day with people on a wine tour, or I work a couple of days at a winery where we do private appointments, and you have an hour and a half with people. And usually those wine conversations last about 30 minutes. And then the rest of the hour and a half is talking about life and, you know, sort of what you've experienced and where you're headed. And the level of depth is actually really remarkable, and sometimes more so than it was when I was, you know, sitting with people who were dying, who weren't really able to communicate, or people that were frozen in such grief that they weren't really able to communicate either. And there's, you know, different forms of communication that happens in those times. But I still very much see, like, listening and presence as absolutely central to who I am and things that I've taken directly from my hospice chaplaincy days.
Yeah. Before we wrap this up, I think it's even your second chapter. It's right up front. Van Gogh, The Way of Van Gogh or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
What about Van Gogh? Why is he so upfront in a whole chapter to himself? And what could you end us with? Some tidbits. You know, I can't recall off the top of my head exactly what I read, but I know I chuckled a few times, you know, and thought it was an interesting chapter. What do we glean from Van Gogh?
I was obsessed with him 15 years ago, and it was probably because my life, you know, was so full of struggle and pain, and I just related so much to the sort of tortured, starving artist in him at the time. I still very much love his work, and I have his Red Vineyard at Arles that sits in my living room, which is my all-time favorite work of art. And but there were just some parallels that I had my choice for our trip to France. So we were going to spend time in Paris, and then I knew I wanted to go to one of the major wine producing regions, and there's many, and they're amazing and profound and historic sites. But I chose the south of France in large part because that's where Van Gogh had lived and painted. And I wanted to go and sort of walk in his footsteps, which I was able to do at Arles, where he lived, and painted Starry Night and all of that. But there were just some kind of eerie parallels, I guess, that I was experiencing at the time. Nowadays, I probably wouldn't see it as quite so parallel. But, you know, he was a missionary, actually, to a coal community in Holland. And he ended up being sort of rejected by the church and not really finding a way that he could belong over the long term. And I've experienced some of that as well. And then, but he found his true calling after being basically rejected as a missionary and going through all sorts of travails about that. But then he found his calling as an artist shortly thereafter. And I think there was just some level of my subconscious where I was seeking something new. when I went to France, that I was still working as a hospice chaplain or sort of in between stints, but I knew that there was something more that I was seeking, and I was just connecting with his story, whether consciously or subconsciously. And I just find it, but you know, here's a man that found his true calling sort of in the midst of and after going through a great deal of rejection, a woman that he loved who rejected him, a church that he wanted to serve that rejected him, a community that couldn't really support him. And that's what drove him to his true calling. And I think there's some real parallels in my story as well.
When did he sell his first painting?
As far as I know, you read different things, but what I've read many times is that he only sold one painting in his entire lifetime. And it's the one that I have, the Red Vineyard at Arles. I definitely recommend, look it up. It's a stunning, brilliant piece of work. And there's a man sort of walking down this rain-slicked road on the top right of the painting that I'm convinced is Van Gogh, though I'm probably wrong. And but I still like related to that, and I kind of used that image throughout the first couple chapters of the book. But as far as I know, he only sold one painting in his entire lifetime.
That's nutty.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, you like, we look at somebody's, we just think of him as a painter and this and that, and that his actual whole life he only sold one painting while he's living.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. Yeah.
Hey, thanks for being on. You're on Amazon. Where do you recommend people go? Is that the place to go, or do you have a website?
I don't really have a website anymore. You can contact me on Instagram, Adam McHugh Wine. The book's called Blood from a Stone, a memoir of how wine brought me back from the dead. I'm a huge fan of supporting local bookstores. You can order it through any bookstore anywhere, or you can find it on Amazon, or bookshop.org is a great option as well, because they support local bookstores through their work.
Great. All right. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you, Ken.
Counted among the outlaws, he said, come follow me. People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.